This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump has condemned the Saudi government's killing and cover-up of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate earlier this month in Istanbul.
They did the wrong thing in even thinking about the idea. They certainly did a bad job of execution, and they certainly did a bad job of talking about it or covering it up, if you'd like to say that.
Mr. Trump described the murder and aftermath a total fiasco. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. identified some of the alleged participants.
We have identified at least some of the individuals responsible, including those in the intelligence services, the royal court, the foreign ministry, and other Saudi ministries who we suspect to have been involved in Mr. Khashoggi's death.
Washington said it's revoking the visas or making ineligible for visas 21 Saudis and held out the possibility of sanctions. Earlier, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on Riyadh to search from top to bottom for those implicated. He said there are strong signs the murder was premeditated, not spontaneous. This is all very real to Marina Litvinenko, widow of Russian agent Alexander Litvinenko, killed by radioactive poison in 2006.
I think international community need to have a call wake-up. Journalists in Russia will have a list of names, people who've been killed in Russia. And I think it's a good point to see if it might be something might change.
Saudi Arabia is conducting its own investigation, has detained or dismissed several people. Zimbabwean opposition leader Nelson Chamisa Tuesday called for a transitional government to resolve that country's worsening economic and political climate.
Indeed, our country has been sent on a free throw and also is in a difficult situation on account of the predatory policies of this unelected government.
He said the first step would be a political dialogue. This is VOA News. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says Washington will press ahead with its decision to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty over Russian violations. Bolton, who held 2 days of talks in Moscow, including one Tuesday with President Vladimir Putin, was asked if the U.S. planned to reintroduce nuclear missiles in Europe.
We're a long way from any decisions on those kinds of questions. I think it was important from our perspective, as President Trump said on Saturday and said again yesterday, to deal with the question of Russian violations of the INF treaty. It's a position Russia doesn't agree with, but which we feel very strongly about.
The Kremlin denies violating the treaty and warned it will be forced to respond to any U.S. arms buildup. The National Security Advisor also admonished Moscow for meddling in U.S. elections, a charge it denies. And he also indicated Mr. Putin and President Donald Trump plan to meet on the sidelines of next month's centennial observance of the end of World War I in Paris. Israeli troops shot and killed a Gazan teenager Tuesday and wounded several others during a protest along the Israeli frontier. Israel's military said its troops came under attack near the border fence and used riot dispersal methods and live fire. Japanese journalist Junpei Yasudo, kidnapped more than 3 years ago in Syria, is now believed to have been released by his captors. Chief Japanese Cabinet Minister Yoshihide Suga said Tokyo is receiving information. He was released and is now in an immigration facility in Turkey. The 44-year-old freelancer was abducted in June 2015 and was seen in a video early this year. The identity of his captors remains unknown. Vietnamese lawmakers Tuesday almost unanimously elected Communist Party Chief Nguyen Phu Trong as president a month after his predecessor, Tran Dai Quang, died. The 74-year-old Trong is the first Vietnamese leader to hold both titles since the rule of founding president Ho Chi Minh. Hurricane Willa, Category 3 storm, made landfall along Mexico's Pacific coast late Tuesday with winds in excess of 160 kilometers per hour. The storm moved inland near the town of Atikapan, about 100 kilometers south of the coastal resort of Mazatlan, prompting thousands to evacuate. U.S. stocks fell in Tuesday trading with investors concerned over corporate earnings. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar announcing it's maintaining its 2018 earnings forecast after two previous quarters of gains. The benchmark Dow Jones shedding nearly 130 points to close at 25,191. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia is celebrating 54 years of independence today, Wednesday, but the opposition says there is very little to rejoice about.
This political freedom is supposed to impair the enjoyment of fundamental civil liberties and human rights. Right now, those rights are not being enjoyed under the current political status in Zambia.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the deputy spokesman of Zambia's main opposition UPND party. Islamic banking grows in Africa as Muslim population expands. South Sudan allocates $3.5 million to celebrate the signing of the current peace agreement. And Zimbabwe lifts a ban on most imported basic commodities.
All we are doing is increasing the supply of commodities. But it is our business to make sure that we have food on the table. And so this is progress, actually. Are these basic commodities duty-free? They are not.
Mthuli Mbe is the Zimbabwe's Minister of Finance, and the Trump administration creates a new development assistance agency to counter China. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia is celebrating 54 years of independence today, Wednesday, but the opposition says there is very little to celebrate. Neighboring Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa arrived in Lusaka yesterday for bilateral talks and also to take part in the Independence Day festivities. The main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says the country under President Edgar Lungu has turned into a police state where there is an erosion of the rule of law and political rights. But their government says Zambia today enjoys multi-party democracy as evident by the holding of record number of free and fair elections and peaceful transition of power. Cornelius Mwitwa is a member of parliament and deputy spokesman of Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development.
It is a mixed feeling, I must say, because as a member of the opposition and also as a member of parliament, I understand that this day is a great day on the national calendar of our politics and the life of the country, because this is a day when we commemorate and celebrate the attainment of political freedom. Essentially, this political freedom is supposed to impair the enjoyment of fundamental civil liberties and the enjoyment of human rights, the right to peaceably assemble and be able to share ideas in the marketplace provided by democracy enshrined in the Constitution. Right now, those rights are not being enjoyed under the current political status in Zambia. We are now grappling with the Public Order Act, which requires that for citizens to assemble and enjoy their right of assembly and be able to hold meetings and processions, they notify the police. The arbitrary arrest of political leaders, we are seeing reckless borrowing, especially from China.
Let me say, Mr. Mwitwa, the government in power say that in 54 years, Zambia came from colonial rule to multi-party democracy and the rule of law. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that at the present moment, there is a breakdown in the rule of law. There is a selective application of the law, which is an affront to the rule of law and good governance that espouses equality before the law, and also recognition and respect for human rights. You find that there's a lot of fear in the minds of citizens. Citizens cannot express themselves freely. So currently, I think that there is no rule of law. Yes, it is 54 years of independence, but then what do we have to show for it in terms of the growth of democracy? And also, what do we have to show for it in terms of economic development?
You mentioned, Mr. Mwitwa, economic emancipation. The government of President Edgar Lungu can say that economic emancipation means that the country needs to modernize. And that is by going out and getting some foreign assistance on a bilateral level, you would say. So I know that people in Zambia have some concerns about the government going and borrowing money from China. What is your take? Because that money is supposed to be used to modernize the country.
Well, of course, that is what is supposed to be the case. unfortunately and profoundly so, this Death Mountain has two or three negative attributes about it. Number one, you find that most of this debt is being acquired from China, and the arrangement about this debt is that China comes to provide the labor force. They bring laborers from China. Of course, Zambia is getting employed, but I can tell you now that you have Chinese drivers, you know, driving caterpillars, those that are involved in the construction of roads. I mean, this is unthinkable. This is what Zambians are questioning.
Mr. Muitwa, so nice to talk with you on this Independence Day, and let me say happy Independence Day to you.
Thank you very much, and we're so grateful for giving us this platform to interact with the rest of the world. Thank you again.
Cornelius Muitwa is a member of parliament and deputy spokesman of Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Zimbabwe government has lifted a ban on most imported basic commodities in light of the country's current acute shortage of most essential commodities over the past few weeks. But the main opposition leader says the country's economic problems will only end when there is a transitional authority and when the country abandons its own currency called bond notes and replaces it with the U.S. dollar. Columbus Mavonga reports from Harare.
After this week's cabinet meeting, Monica Mchangwa, Minister of Information, told reporters in Harare late Tuesday that President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government hopes that by allowing Zimbabweans to import basic commodities, the country will ease recent shortages and price increases. But just take a listen to some of the commodities to get an appreciation of Zimbabwe's current shortages.
Animal oils, baked beans, body creams, bottled water, cereals, cheese, coffee creamers, cooking oil, wheat flour, ice cream, margarine, peanut butter, pizza base, salad creams, shoe polish, soap, sugar, yogurts.
Muturi Ncube, Minister of Finance, explains why the government now allows Zimbabweans to import some of these basic commodities in short supply.
All we are doing is increasing the supply of commodities. And it is our business to make sure that we have food on the table. And so this is progress, actually. Are these basic commodities duty-free? They are not. So the duty still applies. Those are still enforced, and there's no limit on quantity.
While government suspects sabotage on the shortages and price increases, economists say President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government's recent introduction of a 2% tax on all electronic financial transactions caused panic and confusion on the market. Nelson Chamisa, the leader of the country's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, on Tuesday said the new tax must be scrapped as it was more burden on already suffering Zimbabweans. He said President Mnangagwa had failed to run the country alone and to address the current economic crisis.
Mr. Mnangagwa can go to Davos, he can go to China, he can go. Nobody would listen to him. When I also go, I'll be saying another tune. Now that discord does not help the country. We need to have a chorus of the way forward. It requires a common view, a conversation. Because conversations build a nation. Our people are suffering. We need a national transitional authority. That transitional authority is the one that is going to then lay the framework for these steps so that we resolve this crisis. Stop pretending that the bond and the U.S. dollar are one-on-one.
Chamisa said the country must demonetize bond notes. That is a currency Zimbabwe has been printing over the past 2 years to address cash shortages. But that has not helped the situation, with some people spending hours or nights in lines outside banks hoping to get cash. The shortages have extended to bread, cooking oil, medical drugs, and fuel, among others. But President Mnangagwa's government now hopes that by allowing Zimbabweans to import these commodities on their own, the shortages will ease. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
Today's Wednesday, October 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Islamic banking is on the rise worldwide, but has recently shown especially strong growth in Africa, according to the rating agency Moody's. This type of banking system uses physical assets to underpin transactions. It does not charge or pay interest, and it does not invest in so-called sin industries like alcohol, pork, and gambling. As VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, the growth of Islamic banking extends to South Africa, the continent's financial hub.
When Farhan Motiar took over his father's bridal shop in Johannesburg's oldest Indian mall, he decided to do something different. He persuaded his father to migrate away from traditional banking and into newly available Islamic banking systems. The process has been smooth, he says. He did not even switch banks, as South Africa's biggest full-service banks all offer Islamic banking. It is a growing trend across the continent.
We still use the bank. We still need the loans. We still need to finance our way forward to progress, but just by changing a few things, it makes a difference. The idea is basically, so from conventional banking, it's basically the way they lend money versus Islamic banking, where they invest the money and you earn your return. One's profit share and the other's interest.
The head of Islamic banking at South Africa's First National Bank, Aman Mohammed, says business is booming as Africa's Muslim population expands.
We're seeing a steady growth, and this is not just from FNB's perspective, but I believe from the other banks who play in the sector as well.
He says Islamic banking can offer wider benefits to African nations. He noted the successful 2014 issue in South Africa of a $500 million Islamic-compliant bond called a sukuk.
For the first time, we're hearing of governments like the Tanzanian government talking about sukuk issuance, the Kenyan government talking about sukuk issuance. We've heard of Nigeria doing sukuk. And, you know, I think as the prominence of sukuk and the success starts becoming more apparent, we're probably going to see more African countries using this as a mechanism to develop infrastructure within their own countries.
But not everyone is a believer. South African Islamic scholar Mufti AK told VOA he believes Islamic banking's distinction between interest and profit is purely semantic. He advises his students against it.
There is nothing Islamic about it. 90% of the people involved were scholars for dollars in this thing here. They're just playing with semantics and looking for loopholes and skullduggery. That's what's happening.
But Motiar says he is working to convince his fellow businessmen to make the switch, even if this banking option is not always cheaper.
I, as a Muslim person, believe there's more blessing in doing the right thing. So for me, that's exactly why I do think that Islamic banking is the future.
While some Muslim shopkeepers profess doubt, others say they are thinking about it, because they say if they can maintain their faith and make money doing it, well, it just makes sense. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The South Sudan government has allocated 700 million South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $3.5 million, for peace celebrations later this month. President Salva Kiir's spokesman is defending the lavish expense for a party while hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese go hungry. Ateng Wek Ateng says the party is a good gesture to show that the Juba government is serious about implementing the peace agreement. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Juba has set October 30th as the day to celebrate the signing of the revitalized agreement to resolve the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan, the deal signed in Khartoum last month by the government and opposition parties. Presidential spokesman Ateng Wek Ateng says the day provides an opportunity for President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar to show the world they are going to work together again.
It's not a matter of celebration only alone, but it's also cementing the relations between the political leaders who were actually fighting themselves, and to show in front of people of South Sudan that they are confident to work among themselves. So, as people say always, peace has never been free of charge.
Some Juba residents say it is outrageous that the government is willing to spend millions of dollars on a celebration when fighting continues in parts of the country and thousands of people still don't have enough to eat. Resident Malek David is one of them. He says the citizens deserve a public apology from Kiir and Machar.
If this celebration is going to happen, we need all of them to come forth and seriously apologize to the citizens for what they have done, for the ruins they have caused, and let it be sincere from their hearts, because I believe the people who are the citizens are hurt. They are very hurt, and there's no kind words that can, you know, bring them back to joy or the jolly mood that they've always been, because they have lost many dear ones.
A recent report by the Sentry says more than 300,000 people were killed in the conflict. At least 4 million South Sudanese were forced to flee their homes, either to live in refugee camps of neighboring countries or IDP settlements. David says he's spending this kind of money on a celebration is wrong.
When you bring out a budget as big as this, you know, if there are questions, why is it that this budget is coming up right now? And with all this time, people have been, you know, suffering and nothing has been provided to help these needy people.
Ateny says it costs money to invite opposition political leaders to Juba.
If you are to invite leaders to come from outside, including the opposition leaders who would be coming to Juba, and you want to put their security, you know, at the highest level, okay, you will also be paying the security cost. You will be accommodating them. These are not free of charge. And this amount is within reason.
Another Juba resident who prefers to be identified only as Grace believes it is appropriate to spend $3.5 million on a celebration so long as it helps foster unity among the South Sudanese people and ensure peace prevails.
It's worthy because when you look at the past experiences that people have gone through, there has been a lot. People have suffered now that they have invested that money for peace celebration. Let it come through. Let it really come through because we have waited for this.
Ateny says the Kiir administration has invited several heads of state from the IGAD and East African community to attend the celebration in Juba. The huge party will take place at the John Garang Mausoleum. Streets in Juba have been decorated and billboards have gone up on major streets announcing the celebrations. Some of the billboards bear the pictures of President Kiir and Riek Machar shaking hands while in Khartoum. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A high court judge in Juba on Tuesday sentenced a 47-year-old government official to 10 years in prison for raping and defiling a 9-year-old girl. Former Fangag State Health Minister John Dang was arrested after raping the girl last January, but was freed shortly after he threatened the girl's parents. The civil society group Screen of Rights took up the case in September and had Dang rearrested. Winnie Cyrano reports from Juba.
Almudan John Dengboth.
Suspect John Dengboth, the court charges you as follows. 1. Imprisonment for a period of 10 years, starting from January 21st, 2018.
Federal Judge Mujahid Abdullahi Akol announces both sentences in a small courtroom inside a Juba police station in front of 15 people, including the victim's father. Olimp Gadin, an aunt of the victim, says she is satisfied that both will stay behind bars for a long time.
I'm so, so very happy. God bless the Justice Juba. Even he attacked me with 5 guns, 5 police.
Her husband, Member of Parliament Philip Palette Gadin, says both sent military officers and state officials to coerce the family into withdrawing the case. But the family refused to do so. Gadin says both should have received a longer prison sentence for defiling a 9-year-old girl.
We expected maximum sentence so that this thing can deter others. But it's all right. I'm happy that he's proven guilty and the kind of sentence he received is not bad.
Red Malowal, Executive Director for Screen of Rights, strongly encourages all rape victims as well as victims of other crimes to seek legal assistance.
Sometimes people may not have a zeal to pursue justice because they think they cannot get it. But now it's a precedent that people can be able to seek justice and they can get it.
Defense lawyer Robert Badri of Badri and Associates says he's pleased with today's outcome, even though he wanted the maximum sentence.
We opted for 14 years. That is the maximum sentence. But we also know that in any case, there are mitigating factors that courts take into consideration while rendering a judgment. So to me, as the legal counsel to the complainants, I see it from the perspective of justice.
Badri says when he agreed to represent the victim 2 months ago, the accused was free to roam the streets of Juba while attending court sessions. But he says the prosecution will ensure that Deng finishes his 10th term. He also believes a man accused of raping a child should be held without bond until a verdict is reached. The vast majority of rape cases in South Sudan never get to court because victims do not report the crime for fear of the stigma often attached to the victim. Many also don't believe anything will be done to punish the perpetrators. Both was still serving as chairman of a state commission on peace, healing and reconciliation when he was sentenced. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
President Donald Trump has signed a bill establishing a new foreign investment agency that aims to facilitate $60 billion of private lending for infrastructure projects in developing nations. Some see this as a reversal for a president who campaigned on an America First strategy that proposed slashing funding for international assistance. As White House correspondent Patsy Vidakuswara reports, the move was done to counter China's growing influence in Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
The Furi Lebu Station outside of Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, is a main stop in the first modern light rail system of sub-Saharan Africa. It connects the landlocked country to maritime ports in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. The massive infrastructure project was built with Chinese funding.
When the Trump administration, very senior people in the Trump administration, traveled to Asia, when they traveled to other parts of the world and saw that China was eating our lunch, they thought to themselves, we have to do something.
And they did. Last month, the Trump administration quietly created a new development assistance entity, the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, or IDFC, based on bipartisan legislation called the Build Act.
Well, I think it's quite significant that the Congress and the administration, in a bipartisan manner, have recognized the importance of development finance to U.S. promoting development around the world.
It's quite a reversal for a president who wanted to slash foreign aid as part of a broader plan to change how Washington engages with the world.
We reject the ideology of globalism.
The new agency will replace OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, giving it bigger authority and more funds. Trump and some Republicans had previously wanted to end OPIC, skeptical that facilitating loans for companies doing business in developing countries is a good use of government resources. But they're faced with One Belt, One Road, over $1 trillion of Chinese investment in infrastructure projects around the world. It has strengthened Beijing geopolitically, but there are signs of trouble for the recipients.
China is on its way to being the drug dealer of international finance. There's a much larger global conversation today about debt sustainability because they are offering easy money on funny terms that aren't really necessarily transparent or follow kind of international norms.
Beijing has rejected accusations that its loans end up creating a debt trap for developing countries. With only $60 billion, analysts say the new IDFC will not be enough to counter Chinese investments around the world, but its influence can be magnified by partnering with other international lending organizations.
The French, the British, Scandinavians, they all have similar organizations. And now that the IDFC has equity authority, this new entity will be able to be a much more effective partner than OPIC could be.
And for developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that can benefit from more American investments, it's a step in the right direction. Patsy Vidakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Zambia is celebrating 54 years of independence today, Wednesday, but the opposition says there is very little to celebrate. The main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says the country under President Edgar Lungu has turned into a police state where there is an erosion of the rule of law and political rights. But the government says Zambia today enjoys multi-party democracy as evident by the holding of a record number of free and fair elections and peaceful transitions of power. That is it for this Wednesday, October 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.